From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, when most anti-war Americans and their elected representatives were mostly keeping mum, a group called Artists United to Win Without War issued a strong statement to President Bush, signed by 100 celebrities, including Kim Basinger, Carl Reiner, and David Duchovny. That was followed this month by actors at rallies and actors in commercials, like this one by Martin Sheen, urging Americans to join this week's virtual march on Washington.
Don't invade Iraq. Inspections work, war won't. The virtual march on Washington will allow every American opposed to the war to stand up and be counted by calling, faxing, and emailing the U.S. Senate and the White House.
Rob Walker, writing this week in Slate, suggests that using front men and women like Sheen and Janine Garofalo in ads may actually work against the anti-war movement. Rob, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about the Martin Sheen ad. Do you think it was effective?
No, I don't think it was particularly effective. I think it's getting a lot of this sort of attention in terms of people talking about the issue of whether or not celebrities are worthwhile figures on whether or not the United States should get involved in a war with Iraq. And so you have to kind of keep that in mind when you evaluate this ad. It isn't happening in a vacuum. We've been talking about this for weeks in one way or another.
So are you saying that using the celebrity actor serves as a distraction, perhaps, from the real issue?
Well, an interesting point of view on this was actually expressed not long ago by Janine Garofalo in one of the other ads. She was talking to a reporter about why it is that celebrities so often seem to be the people who are showing up on the nightly chat shows to take an anti-war line. And it was her point of view that celebrities are picked to do this because they, in one way or another, trivialize or defang the anti-war movement. And that's an interesting point of view. And the curious thing about it is that if she and others presumably feel this way, why they would think it would be effective for them to show up in the advertising that promotes that same point of view.
I could see Janine Garofalo or virtually anybody becoming an easy target for, say, Bill O'Reilly, who's willing to attack families of the victims of 9/11 in his pursuit of the war. Janine Garofalo has stated the view that the press is pretty much walking in lockstep with the Bush administration. But isn't it really a matter of numbers that you have a celebrity face in there and people are more likely to stay tuned?
I think that's probably a bigger factor than the idea that the media is in any way sort of conspiring to trivialize anybody's point of view on this. I think that when you book a talk show, a well-known person is probably always going to be better than an unknown person.
It was the contention in your column that using ads might actually have the effect of turning the public away from the message. Why do you think that the public isn't likely to be swayed by that kind of an ad?
Well, one of the things you don't see so much of anymore in just plain old non-political product-pushing advertising is exactly this kind of model where famous person A shows up, says, well, I eat cereal brand X, and therefore you should eat cereal brand X. You really don't see that kind of advertising so much anymore. People kind of stop buying that line. They see it as being false and insincere. Obviously, you still see celebrities in ads, but they're used in a more sophisticated way now.
So you're saying the sort of, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV model has become something of a cliche?
Yeah, there's an interesting example of it that ran actually during the Super Bowl, an ad that got a lot of attention that featured Willie Nelson. And the premise of that ad was that Willie Nelson was considering whether or not he would do an advertisement endorsing shaving cream, which at first he dismissed as a ridiculous thing to do, but then he ended up having to do it because he was in tax trouble. So the ad really turned out to be an ad for H&R Block, and the message being, well, gee, if only Willie Nelson had used us, he wouldn't have to do something so crass and silly as pitching shaving cream. So as you can see there, the idea of a celebrity looking at the camera and saying, use this or do this because I do it or I think it, is not something that people take seriously. In fact, it's a punchline.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Rob Walker is a columnist for Slate.com. His most recent column is called The Ads of War.
Some policy wonks and pundits may feel threatened when movie stars and other uncredentialed creatives poach on their public policy turf. Others say turnabout is fair play. We present now NPR senior news analyst Daniel Schorr as Dirty Harry.
What you doing, you pighead sucker? Every day for the last 10 years, Loretta there has been giving me a large black coffee. Today, she gives me a large black coffee, only it's got sugar in it. A lot of sugar. I just came back to complain. Now, you boys, put those guns down.
Say what?
Well, we're not just gonna let you walk out of here.
Who's we, sucker?
Smith and Wesson and me. Go ahead, make my day.
Though many actors lead the charge for liberal causes, it's conservative thespians who get elected. Song and dance man George Murphy used his job as president of the Screen Actors Guild as a stepping stone to the U.S. Senate in 1964. His successor as Guild president, Ronald Reagan, also had some success in politics. And of course, the two shared something else. They were both Republicans. According to On the Media's John Solomon, this is more than just a coincidence.
California State Senator Sheila Kuehl is one of the nation's few openly lesbian elected officials. But she is a member of an even rarer political minority group, former actors who have been voted to office as Democrats. Kuehl, who played Zelda Gilroy on the early 60s TV series The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, is only the third such Democrat elected in modern American history. Previously, theater actress Helen Gahagan Douglas was sent to Congress from Los Angeles in 1944. Ben Jones, Cooter on The Dukes of Hazzard, represented a suburban Atlanta district in the U.S. House from 1988 to 1992. Yet beginning with song and dance man George Murphy, who was elected to the U.S. Senate from California in 1964, the Republican Party has fielded a larger cast of elected performers. Ronald Reagan followed in Murphy's footsteps, going from winning one for the Gipper to winning more than one for the GOP. In 1986, Fred Grandy left the Love Boat to go to Congress. Sonny Bono joined him there in 1994. Clint Eastwood successfully ran for mayor of Carmel, California. And Fred Thompson just finished serving 8 years in the U.S. Senate before returning to acting as, ironically, an elected district attorney on NBC's Law & Order. Sheila Kuehl suggests one reason for the Republican advantage is that Democratic actors need to build a political resume before party leaders and voters feel they are qualified for office.
Whereas many Republican candidates who get elected can be more personalities or simply anti-government. And sometimes a lack of experience is considered a plus in a Republican campaign. One is thought to be, you know, fresh and unspoiled, as it were.
Geography is another explanation. According to Ron Brownstein, author of The Power and the Glitter, which examines the relationship between Hollywood and Washington, Democratic actors working and living in Los Angeles or New York often find their ambitions blocked by the lines of Democratic politicians also interested in running. And there are not many places in the middle of the country where a liberal Democratic actor can realistically win, because they can be tarred with Hollywood's Sodom and Gomorrah reputation. GOP actors don't have that problem. Ron Brownstein.
It may be a little easier for the Republicans than the Democrats to make the jump, and it's for a good Hollywood reason, and that it's playing against type. You are, in effect, insulated from the inevitable charge that you stand for a liberal institution that's corrupting American morals.
Also politically damaging to liberal celebrities is that activism on the coasts can make them appear more extremist in the heartland, even among moderate Democratic voters. That's according to the Dukes of Hazzard's Ben Jones, the only former actor elected as a Democrat outside of Los Angeles.
The nature of the issues around Screen Actors Guild politics and things like that sort of push these folks to the left, to not a moderate or centrist Democratic Party viewpoint, but on the left fringe. Warren Beatty and Barbara Streisand, people who are always talking about running for president and have high political profiles, couldn't get elected dog catcher in this neck of the woods in Virginia.
Most Democratic actors who have run recently have lost decisively. Ralph Waite, Pa in The Waltons, was soundly defeated by Sonny Bono. Actor Barry Gordon, also a former SAG president, lost a California congressional race in 1998. Nancy Culp, banker Jane Hathaway on the Beverly Hillbillies, tried unsuccessfully for Congress from Pennsylvania. It didn't help that co-star Buddy Ebsen campaigned for her GOP opponent. it is likely that the Republicans will continue to recruit in Hollywood. Democrats, on the other hand, have actively solicited celebrities' financial resources and public support, but the party has not made as much of an effort to sign them up as candidates. Sheila Kuehl.
It would be a useful thing for the party to think seriously about who might be a good candidate and begin to speak to them.
Kuehl nominates Tom Hanks and Martin Sheen as actors warranting special attention. Indeed, that could be the problem. It may be that politically active Democrats are having too much success to change careers. Veteran actor and former SAG president Richard Masser.
There has never been anybody who ran for office at the height of their career. Ronald Reagan's career was basically over when he went into politics.
So, maybe the key for Democrats looking to even the political score is to make sure Republican-leaning actors keep working. After Ronald Reagan became governor of California, movie director William Wyler remarked to a Democratic colleague, "If we had only given him a couple of good parts, he'd never be in Sacramento now." For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
And now a few letters. We had a strong response to my interview with radio producer Helen Borton, who cut some ugly tape about family life on a military base out of her documentary when the soldiers were called into action. Adam Crane of Beaverton, Oregon, said he had some questions about her decision, but appreciated her candor. Judith Catterall of Portland, Oregon, went farther, writing that all over the world, women are struggling against impossible odds to stand and say, "We will be prey no more." Ms. Borton's choice to ease up on one of the predators is an old choice, and I'm sorry to say, an uninspired one.
Sam Coleman wrote in to correct my reference to the dead at My Lai in my interview with military historian Robert Bateman. The number of Vietnamese civilians killed by American troops was not 300, but 504. On the online effort to name a patron saint for the Internet, Regina Sansaloni of Cincinnati, Ohio, wrote in to say that Pope John Paul enlisted three saints back in 1997. Raphael, patron saint of pharmacists to oversee the databases, Gabriel, patron saint of messengers to watch over email, and of course Michael, patron saint of the dying to protect against viruses and hackers.
May Gabriel continue to shepherd your email to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. Don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Up next, the departure of some kinder, gentler broadcasters and the best website for dirty laundry, The Smoking Gun.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. I was a late convert to the Church of Mr. Rogers. In fact, for a very long time, I was pretty much repulsed by the man, by all the saccharine sincerity, the Pollyanna worldview, the numbing repetition, the purple cardigans matched with olive green trousers, the ugliest decor in the developed world. I couldn't stand the whole wimpy deal, and I couldn't stand it day after day after damn beautiful day. Then I started watching my children watch him and, over the years, began to understand. When you were 3 or 4 years old and you were a little steel ball in the pinball machine of life and you land against an innocuous-looking bumper and are instantaneously propelled, don't touch that, full speed and out of control, to another apparently safe port only to be jettisoned again, no, you may not do that. with seemingly no place to alight, there's something to be said for bland security and patience and unequivocal kindness, for drapes that hideously defy grown-up convention by being colorful for colorfulness' sake, for the rare expression in a world of harried and jaded adults of the presumption of innocence. In a world awash in parenting pathologies large and small, Mr. Rogers was a totally dependable adult. And that's where his saintliness finally hit home for me, because who else is? Yeah, he had some wardrobe issues, but he never once neglected my children in favor of a sporting event or tax preparation. He never reneged on a promise. When he said he was going to the sneaker factory, by God, he was going there. He never exploded like flash powder before their eyes. He never made Mommy cry. It's not just that he was a counterbalance to the media's poisonous other influences. Mr. Rogers was also the antidote to me. And for that, I will never stop being grateful.
Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
MSNBC pulled the plug this week on Phil Donahue's short live talk show, an abrupt end to his much-ballyhooed comeback. Donahue struck back at his bosses Wednesday, saying they were too quick to pull the trigger and that they might be trying to, quote, outfox Fox with ever more conservative voices. Now, that might sound like just another angry rebuke from a disgruntled ex-employee, except for the existence of an NBC report that could, if genuine, go some way to substantiating Donahue's claim. Rick Ellis, who runs a website called AllYourTV.com, says an NBC insider gave him that internal report, and he called some network higher-ups to verify it.
What I was able to do is find some of the other people that got it and got them to, at least off the record, say, yes, I did receive it. It was a very difficult thing to do, though, because obviously it's not the kind of thing that they like having out there.
How important do you think these internal memos generally are? I mean, who writes them and whose opinions do they represent?
Any network does a lot of internal tracking. They do a lot of focus groups. They do a lot of, these are the demographics. Why is this demographic slipping? Why are people tuning out in this particular half hour? You see these things endlessly. I mean, I would guess that the average network must generate hundreds of them in the course of a year. This is not an out of the ordinary type of study at all. It's just because of Donahue's prestige and just the fact that he was perhaps the one big liberal voice out there on cable news TV. It definitely made an impact with people.
Well, Phil Donahue said he saw the writing on the wall last September, 2 months into his MSNBC talk show, when he told colleague Jerry Nachman that if the numbers didn't click by January, he'd be out. The irony, of course, is that his numbers did click, didn't they?
They did, pretty much from the beginning. And his show has been the highest rate on MSNBC. The problem is that in the universe of ratings, the channel is so far in third place behind Fox and CNN that it's real easy to say, well, the ratings were down. He's getting an audience that's so much smaller than Bill O'Reilly or so much smaller than Connie Chung. We had to cancel him.
Okay, so it was widely noted that Phil Donahue's audience was 5 times smaller than Bill O'Reilly's. But he did beat Chris Matthews, who's heavily promoted all over MSNBC. Ultimately, the report suggests the problem wasn't really about numbers.
Yes. When you look at the study, one of the things that's the most compelling and maybe got the most attention was that I can quote a couple sentences from it, that Donahue presents a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war, and that there was a fear that Donahue's show might become a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. You know, from a television standpoint, from a business standpoint, you certainly understand that. But it presents a bit of a dilemma for liberals. I think you're getting penalized for being too liberal.
But doesn't it also present a problem for the credibility of a network? I mean, at the very time that they're firing Phil Donahue, they're hiring a very conservative commentator, Mike Savage, the ex-GOP politician Dick Armey, who is famous for his extreme views, and Jesse Ventura, who's all over the map politically, I guess. It sounds to me that they're doing more than trying to avoid banging up against unpopular views with regard to the potential war in Iraq and the administration, that they're going way to the other extreme.
The network says very consistently, no. We want a variety of voices. We don't think MSNBC is going too far in the direction towards the right. And that's been pretty much their standard answer. These channels are just desperately wanting to expand their demographics. And to get a large audience, you need people tuning in who will tune in even if they don't particularly like what you're saying, just because they like listening to you. That's the audience that Bill O'Reilly is reaching. Not everyone who watches him regularly really agrees with him, but it's just fun to watch.
Donahue was entertaining, though, wasn't he? The report even says, and I have a quote here, he seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives. That surely must have some entertainment value.
One of the things that was frustrating, I think, for people associated with the show was that they felt that Phil was often constrained, that because the network was very concerned about the image and the type of show he was doing, that every time he would start to get on a roll and he would start to do a show he was very happy with, he was reined in and they would tell him, you need to have more conservative guests.
So basically, MSNBC was too afraid to let Phil Donahue be Phil Donahue the way that Fox lets Bill O'Reilly be Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. And, you know, at the end of the day, either you believe in your person or you don't. Phil Donahue, people want to listen to the guy. And I think ultimately that's really what's most tragic about this is he was one of the few recognizable liberal names out there that people would tune into even if maybe they didn't agree with it.
All right. Rick Ellis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rick Ellis is the founder and editor of AllYourTV.com.
The FCC is poised to scrap most of its ownership limits, a move that public advocates fear will leave virtually all of local TV in the hands of a very few media giants. And according to a new study by the Pew Research Center in collaboration with the Project for Excellence in Journalism, or PEJ, nearly three-quarters of the public knows, quote, nothing at all about it. Nothing at all is also about all that was known until recently about the impact of consolidation on the quality of local TV news. And when the courts prodded the FCC to find some hard data on the issue, the PEJ was more than happy to oblige. For the last 5 years, it's been assessing the quality of newscasts from local TV stations in more than 50 markets. Amy Mitchell, the organization's associate director, says the research led to some surprising conclusions. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, how do you measure quality in local news programming? How do you objectively determine which newscast is better than another?
Well, it's a difficult question, and what we did was assemble a design team of 14 local TV news directors to answer it for us. So they came up with a list of criteria for what makes a quality newscast. It involved things like covering the whole community, being significant and informative, demonstrating enterprise and courage in the coverage, being fair and balanced, being highly local, authoritative. So we took that list of criteria that they developed and then had a team of academics translate it into a way to actually quantify, if you will, story by story, a TV newscast.
What are the results of that research?
The three main findings, in a nutshell, are that smaller is better. Stations owned by small companies, those we defined as owning three stations or fewer, were more than twice as likely to produce the highest quality work than were those owned by the top 10. So the argument the proponents of large companies put forward, which is that by being owned by a large company, you have access to greater resources, to a more experienced staff, and therefore could raise the quality of your newscast. Well, that clearly was not the case in these findings. The second main finding was that local ownership, perhaps surprisingly, was not necessarily better. Many people feel or argue that having a local owner, one that's tied to the community, that's involved in the community, him or herself, would then lead to more sensitive, serious coverage of the issues of the community. But we did not see support for that argument. The third central finding was that stations with cross-ownership, which is when a parent company owns a newspaper in the same community, that those stations actually produced higher quality work than did stations without cross-ownership. Now, there are very few cross-ownership stations that currently exist, but we certainly did see a clear tendency to those in our study having higher quality.
Those stations had been grandfathered in before previous regulations prohibiting cross-ownership.
Exactly.
The anti-deregulation forces tend to want to eliminate cross-ownership altogether. Do you find yourself making an uncomfortable recommendation along those lines?
Well, our goal is to provide objective data. And I think what we have to put forward when we talk about cross-ownership is that it is a very small number of stations. And so there's always a risk that perhaps what you're looking at is an anomaly. But it does suggest that perhaps having a broader base of news-gathering potential could give you some benefit. By having some depth in newspaper gathering, you might be able to increase your quality. We did see a couple of interesting side notes, though, with cross-ownership, which was that the enterprise reporting, the actual sending a reporter out to the scene, doing investigative work, that was not better at cross-ownership versus non-cross-ownership. And that may be because they're relying on the newspaper to provide them with the story rather than going out themselves. We also saw when we brought in the ratings, how well the station was trending when it came to the viewership, that cross-ownership stations were not doing better when it came to ratings. And that may suggest that there's a little bit of difficulty in translating the elements of newspaper into television.
All right. Now, the FCC for some months now has been kind of half-heartedly soliciting input from various interested parties on the question of deregulation. What do you suppose the Federal Communications Commission will do with the data that you're providing?
Well, we hope that they would add this public service element of the quality and character of the news to their decision-making process. Right now, it's absent. Some of the rules certainly do still serve the public.
Well, Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amy Mitchell is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
For scandalmongers, peeping toms, and the garden variety news junkie, there is an online paradise called thesmokinggun.com. Where else would you find private NASA emails related to the shuttle disaster, affidavits attesting to Michael Jackson's indiscretions, the bondage photos of a Joe Millionaire finalist, or documents pertaining to the drug arrest of the crypto stoner Dell computer kid? Court TV, which bought The Smoking Gun 2 years ago, regularly features these finds on the cable channel, but the site is the brainchild of two men, and one of them joins me now. Daniel Green is the managing editor of SmokingGun.com. Danny, welcome to OTM.
Yeah, thank you.
You and William Bastone started the site back in 1997. What inspired you to start Smoking Gun?
Bill and I were longtime reporters in New York. Bill had covered organized crime for the Village Voice and as a freelance writer. And we'd oftentimes come across interesting documents, police reports, court files, FBI files. And there was really no place to publish them. And we thought the internet would be a perfect place.
So describe some of the early postings.
I think the first thing we posted was an FBI memo, which indicated that the Bureau knew Elvis Presley had a drug addiction. And this was several years before Presley died. So we put it up and asked the question, you know, could the FBI have saved Elvis? And nobody noticed. I don't think anybody's ever written us about the story. But we thought it was sort of a bang-off way to begin the site.
When you read in the newspaper and you read a story, or when you just see a person and think about them, are you always constantly, obsessively thinking about what documents may be attached to the person or to the story?
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. About 2 years ago, the actor Ben Affleck was on the cover of GQ magazine. And in the course of the story, he said that he would like to run for Congress someday. So we did a little research, and it turned out he not only wanted to run for Congress someday, but he had done a lot of work for Al Gore in the presidential election that November. He had traveled across the country as part of Al Gore's Get Out the Vote campaign. He'd appeared at a midnight rally the night before election trying to get young people to get out the vote. He appeared on the Rosie O'Donnell show Election Day, when he, in fact, told Rosie, "I'm going out to vote right now." Well, we saw this, and I looked at one of the guys in the office, and I said, "You know what? I bet Ben Affleck isn't registered to vote." So we checked the records. We checked New York. We checked Boston. We checked Los Angeles, any place we thought of. Not only hadn't he voted that November, but he hadn't actually voted in about 10 years. And he wasn't even registered in New York City where he lived.
Now, that's a small and fun little gotcha. How come other people with much bigger staffs and presumably a lot of time on their hands aren't getting to this material first?
I don't think a lot of them have the skills. They come from entertainment reporting backgrounds, which don't really teach the kind of investigative paper trail skills that we have, that we developed when we were writing about city councilmen or mayors or members of the mafia. You know, that's where you learn to go through a court file or how to find a police report or what's available through the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And we've taken those skills and we aim them in a little bit of a different place.
What do you think is the most significant thing that the smoking gun has revealed?
One of the things we did that I think was terrific and did get some worldwide attention was we got Timothy Leary's FBI file. And going through it, it turned out that he was in contact with the FBI quite a bit in the late 60s and early 70s and was giving up information on some of his friends, including some of the people who helped spring him from jail. So I think those kinds of stories, where you get an FBI file and you're able to poke a hole in a commonly held belief, is something that we're very, very proud of.
Have you had a look at Saddam Hussein's declaration of disarmament?
No. There are a lot of reporters who do a terrific job at that. We don't claim to cover everything, although we just posted a document that was released as part of this case in Illinois. There was a group of fundraisers who were apparently siphoning money to al-Qaeda, and there was a memo about the first meeting of al-Qaeda in 98 between bin Laden and one of his confederates, and that was very interesting. It said that in the original meeting that the plan was, and this is a quote, all members of al-Qaeda will have good manners. And I think they've stuck to that, don't you?
With all due respect to everything else that you do on The Smoking Gun, my favorite category of your postings is the celebrity riders, the riders to celebrity contracts for performance gigs. That's where I learned that Bruce Springsteen will have 6 Stonyfield yogurt non-fat assorted flavors, including plain and vanilla, but absolutely not including lemon, or he will not go on stage. So that's my favorite.
They're all funny. Jennifer Lopez had a pretty funny one where backstage she wanted a white room, white table, white couch. She wanted chicken and beans and cookies and a 45-foot trailer. And the only part that's especially strange about that one was that rider was for a charity video she was shooting. And the proceeds of that were going to the families of September 11th victims. So we always thought, you know, you're kind of missing the point.
Well, Danny Green, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Danny Green is managing editor of the website The Smoking Gun.
Coming up, why the sweeps are obsolete, the comic strips are stale, and Godzilla still inspires in a shabby rubber suit.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. TV was hot last Wednesday night. On ABC, Barbara Walters chatted up accused wife murderer Robert Blake, while CBS snagged Robert Chambers, the so-called preppy killer, and Dan Rather sat down with Saddam. America's Most Wanted seemed to be cluttering up the airwaves, and why? Wednesday was the last day of a 4-times-a-year tradition called Sweeps Week. Earlier, the sweeps served up the freakish delights of Michael Jackson and Joe Millionaire, which, by the way, pulled much better ratings than Saddam. During these months, data on viewing habits around the country are collected and used to set prices for advertising. The New Yorker's James Surowiecki has 3 criticisms of the sweeps. They are as follows. One, they are deeply flawed and of little use in the end to the networks, the advertisers, and the viewers. Two, everyone in television knows this. And three, no one has done anything about it. James, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So the sweep system originated in radio almost 50 years ago. That's the Paleolithic era in media years. So give us the basics on how it works.
Well, the way it works is during each sweeps month, Nielsen Media Research sends out something close to a million paper diaries. And they send them to, you know, selected homes. It's supposed to be a random sample. And they basically ask people for 1 week to fill out on this diary everything they watched during that week. And the theory is that what that will allow local advertisers to do is figure out how much they should spend on local advertising, because they will have information not just about what people are watching, but also about who's watching what.
So now let's go through your points one by one. Why are sweeps no good for the networks?
From the network's perspective, they basically have to pack all of their good, or I mean good maybe should be in quotes here if you think about things like Joe Millionaire, but all of their high-profile programming into these 4 months. And they have to spend a lot of money promoting these shows. And that means that through most of the year, they have to sprinkle reruns all over the place.
So why isn't it any good for the advertisers?
There are two problems. One is that there are real questions about how accurate these diaries are. People don't do this as they're watching. Like all of us, they procrastinate, they wait to the end of the week, and then they try to remember what they're watching. So that skews the diaries in one direction. The other thing is that the response rate to these diaries is very small. In other words, of all the diaries Nielsen sends out, only something like 30% are actually filled out.
Okay, so in your column, after you finish trashing the entire system, you do suggest an alternative, which is very nice of you, the Nielsen people meters.
Well, let me explain just for a second how they work. Basically, there are 5,000 homes in America that now have people meters. When you are watching a show, you're supposed to log in. So they know what everyone in the house is watching. So they get this demographic data. And that's the information that the networks use to set their national advertising. The real problem is that even though it would make sense to move the entire country to a people meter system, on the local level, it just doesn't make sense for, you know, a local affiliate to pay to have the homes wired for people meters. And there are two reasons for that. One is that the local advertising markets are probably too small to justify the expense. And the second is that a lot of local affiliates, I think, don't actually want accurate numbers.
So even though the viewers, the networks, and the advertisers are the losers when it comes to using the paper system, the affiliates do seem to derive some benefit from it.
Yeah, they do. And one obvious reason is, again, if you go back to people filling out the diaries, if you think about how people remember, they're more likely to remember high-profile programs, are more likely to remember the networks. You know, if you're thinking, what did I watch on Wednesday? You're probably more likely to put down a network show than, you know, that Discovery Channel show that you happen to catch. And in that sense, the networks really benefit. And in fact, whenever people meters have been introduced, the affiliates' ratings have dropped. And this is really important because the people that pay for sweeps, in other words, literally pay for the data to be collected, are the affiliates. They're paying for it. It's in their interest. So it's probably not surprising that it hasn't changed.
So we're stuck with a system that was born in the days of Milton Berle, and it's distorting the programming we see. It's distorting advertising rates, and it isn't going to change.
No, the only prospect of hope, I think, is that Nielsen is in the process of installing people meters in 25 markets. And it's going to be a very slow rollout. They say they will have it done by 2010. If that happens, then I think the system will probably be obviously not overturned, but it will be modified in important ways, because at least for 25 major markets, you will have this concrete information.
I have to tell you, the reason why we really wanted to call you about this piece is because we loved the last line so much. It was a beautiful play on the old-time expression, the revolution will not be televised.
Right. Yeah, the television will not be revolutionized, and that is, in fact, what we're dealing with.
James Surowiecki, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
James Surowiecki writes the financial page in The New Yorker.
So what do you have against the family circus?
Okay. You sit down and read your paper. and you're enjoying your entire two-page comic spread, right? And then there's the family circus, bottom right-hand corner, just waiting to suck. And that's the last thing you read, so it spoils everything you read before. I hate it, yet I'm uncontrollably drawn to it.
That scene from the 1999 movie Go crystallized a lot of people's feelings about an oddly uncomic strip, but the popularity of these panels is no laughing matter, as many a features editor has learned the hard way. One such is Elizabeth McIntyre of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who a year ago cut Dennis the Menace, Judge Parker, Kathy, Spider-Man, and others, and is still getting letters brimming with reader wrath.
They ranged from, how could you do this to me? My waffles will never taste the same in the morning, to, you stupid idiot. What were you thinking? You should be fired. A lot of the anger came from Spider-Man.
Anger. You said the right word. That's the word you meant to say.
That is the word I meant to say, anger. There was one woman, she was torn apart by it. She was very upset that we would abandon Spider-Man. She kept saying, you know, this is serious to me. Don't think that I'm joking about this. This is serious. One of the saddest calls I got was from a four-year-old saying, you're the one that killed Spider-Man.
Oh, my goodness. That is sad. What did you say to the child?
I felt awful.
We took Spider-Man to the farm. Spider-Man's happy with the other superheroes romping on the farm. I'm just curious. At the time you were getting this hate mail, did you talk to the news editors to find out on any given day how much reaction they were getting to page one stories about, oh, I don't know, the future of the planet and war and various other things that were in the news at the time?
Don't fool yourself. They will always call and complain about the comics and puzzles more than they will anything that's on page one. I mean, that is just the way it is.
To what do you attribute this intense emotional reaction to the funny papers?
They're people's friends. For a lot of readers, that's who they visit first in the morning. With their cup of coffee, they flip to the comic pages before they even look at page one. And they build relationships with these characters. They look forward to, I know here's what I'm going to get. This is what I'm going to get from Marmaduke. This is what I'm going to get from Family Circus. And they can predict that in a world that's sometimes very unpredictable.
Now, let's talk briefly about Family Circus. It's just not funny. Has it ever made you laugh?
No, it hasn't. I mean, it's not a punchline strip. It's a sweet strip. And there's a difference, at least in my mind. Some readers like strips that'll make them go, oh, that's so sweet. And they can relate to it, but they're not looking to get a fall-down laugh over it.
Do you find it maybe a little ironic that the things that they call comics and funnies are neither?
Yeah, I do. But what's funny to me may not be funny to you. I am one person. I am not the queen of comics. I can't even begin to speak to what all of my readers want. So I listened to what they had to say because a lot of them had perceptions that I hadn't even begun to think about.
You drew the line at Marmaduke, though, didn't you?
We only dropped Marmaduke from Sunday. Marmaduke rated very high. Uh-huh. He was in our top five.
Well, you know, the author of Marmaduke has had a chance to refine that one joke 7 days a week for about four decades. So,
do you mean Marmaduke's the big dog?
Yeah, and my goodness, the scrapes he gets into. What's your goal in surveying your readership? When you're trying to revamp the page, are you trying to freshen it, to cultivate young readers, or just antagonize the smallest number of people?
I think the goal ultimately is to try to bring new strips in and to put some other strips out of their misery at that point. And if you don't have that churn going on your comic pages, you don't provide an opportunity for the next great strip to come onto your pages.
All right. Well, Elizabeth McIntyre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth McIntyre is the features editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, where she is now living by the decisions she made a year ago to revamp the funny pages.
The big movies this past holiday season included Chicago, Gangs of New York, and The Hours. But for a certain segment of the movie audience, the release of those films paled in importance to another movie event, the Tokyo opening of Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla. Most Americans think of Godzilla movies, if they think of them at all, as a sort of cheesy relic of the drive-in era. And they're surprised to learn that the Godzilla franchise is still going strong. The latest release is the 26th Godzilla movie since 1954, NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Even before you saw Godzilla, you heard his footsteps falling on the earth ominously, shaking buildings and trees. Soon he would appear in the water or over the crest of a hill, an enormous scaly creature like a dinosaur with a roar that was somewhere between a lion and a giant vacuum cleaner. He had a stiff, lumbering gait and a tail that could squash skyscrapers. He emitted a kind of radioactive beam that he could train on his enemies. He was always getting tangled up in power lines. And when he showed up, whole villages fled in terror. Godzilla was not like American movie monsters. He didn't lurk in the shadows waiting to pounce. He wasn't malevolent. He was a kind of huge, unstoppable force that showed up unexpectedly and, almost despite himself, left a trail of destruction in his wake. And if you grew up in this country in the 60s and 70s, you probably watched his movies after school, usually on the low-rent UHF stations. For fans like John Lippertito and Norman England, there was nothing like Godzilla.
When you're a kid, when like you're a boy, everyone's telling you what to do and everyone can put you down. And then you look at Godzilla and nobody can put this guy down. And he walks around, does what he wants to do, he knocks some buildings over. And just as a boy, I don't know, I felt like, oh, wow, that would be cool if I could do that kind of thing.
I think kids kind of want to be Godzilla, so I think he's a natural child icon.
He's a role model.
In truth, there was never one Godzilla any more than there was one Cinderella or Robin Hood. The first Godzilla movie was a dark, serious story about a monster who was somehow brought to life after nuclear tests in the Pacific. He rampages Tokyo before being killed. As this dubbed American version suggests, the shadow of Hiroshima hangs over the movie.
At 3:30 this morning, a ship from Tokyo was literally wiped from the surface of the ocean in a matter of seconds.
Anything from the ship's radio?
It said there was a blinding flash of light, and the ocean burst into flame.
The first Godzilla was no B-movie. It was the most expensive film ever made in Japan at the time, and its cast and crew included some of Japan's most talented people, including some who worked regularly with Akira Kurosawa. The huge success of Godzilla led to sequels. Godzilla took on new monsters like the gentle Mothra and the three-headed Ghidorah in long, epic clashes that were like battles between gods. To many fans, it was the golden age of Godzilla. But by the late 60s, says film historian David Callett, Godzilla, like the Terminator later on, had changed, going from marauding menace to superhero. This Godzilla saved cities from other monsters.
Partly it was a reflection of the fact that Godzilla was obviously the popular character, and that's the key around which the franchise was revolving. So if you're going to keep bringing back the character over and over and over again, and the audience is going to be there to watch him do his stuff, naturally that audience sympathy works better if you're depicting him as a heroic character rather than a villain.
By the 1970s, monster movies were no longer very profitable, and Godzilla's producer, Toho Studios, started cutting the series' budget.
Godzilla! And Kamakura!
Toho also began aiming Godzilla at children, and the stories became more simplistic, even campy. Callett says one reason so many Americans think of Godzilla movies as crudely made is because they grew up watching the Godzilla of that period.
I've often had the pleasure of taking somebody who has that negative opinion and showing them an earlier film like Godzilla vs. Mothra and watching their eyes open as they go, wow, this is really good.
In the 1980s, Godzilla fans mounted a successful letter-writing campaign to persuade Toho to return to the darker, more serious movies of the past. Since then, Toho has been churning out new movies of varying quality every few years. The most recent movies are, by contemporary standards, pretty low-tech. Godzilla is still played by a man in a rubber suit who tromps through miniature cities. And that is fine with fans. For people like Norman England, part of the appeal of the old Godzilla movies was that they didn't look realistic.
Today, there's kind of a more of an emphasis in both Japanese films and American films on looking real. And what I really liked about in the 60s was it didn't necessarily look real. It looked like another world. And the miniatures themselves kind of hold an appeal like a very intricately designed HO scale train set. So as a boy, I mean, I just would just watch these films with my mouth hanging down.
Trying to put Godzilla in the real world, fans say, somehow detracts from his power, making him just another movie monster. A few years ago, Columbia TriStar released an American version of Godzilla starring Matthew Broderick. It had all the special effects money could buy. Godzilla tramped through the streets of Manhattan looking realer and scarier than ever before.
God, come on. Let's go.
One second, all right? One second. This is unbelievable.
The movie was a box office disappointment, and many Godzilla fans in particular loathed it. Still, Toho has continued putting out Godzilla movies in Japan, and Godzilla remains one of the few Japanese entertainment exports that's instantly recognizable around the world. A few years ago, when the 6'2" Osaka-born Hideo Nomo went to pitch for the Los Angeles Dodgers, he was nicknamed Godzilla, and no one had to explain the reference. After nearly half a century of doing battles against monsters of all kinds, Godzilla continues to triumph, at least as a cultural icon. For On the Media, this is Jim Zaroli.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Manoli Wetherill and Brian Tilley. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme, not this one. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Godzilla!
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydale Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.